Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy and WGN and Ben Bradley over there at WGN took up the story of pensions, we've been talking about here for, I don't know, the 6.5 years I've been here.
Every day.
I've been talking for the 25 years I've been in Illinois politics.
Hey, do you still have that stack where we shuffle through and then you tell me when to stop and we pick out a random person and how much money they're going to make when
they
retire?
What they put in versus what the guaranteed payout is and so on and so forth. You know, when you listen to this story, and this focuses in on a very specific aspect of the pension scam in this state. For politicians specifically, maybe this will get people a little bit more animated, those that are otherwise lobotomized by the public sector union's rhetoric about what public sector workers deserve, how the guarantees they should have for salary, benefits, job security that are non-existent in the public sector. Maybe this will draw some ire. Maybe this will wake a few people up by focusing on loathsome politicians that are much more easier to really despise and say, well, that's not fair. You know, it's easy to have courage in criticizing Mike Madigan, right? That's cheap. Thinking about this, though, too, when you hear the conversation about pensions, and this wasn't included because network affiliate news can, you know, is limited in their understanding of things, and so they don't do a very good job of connecting dots, lack of consequence and context. But when we talk about pensions, you should hear, if you're not a public sector worker, even if you are, but inextricably linked is my home value. My home value, property taxes.
Biggest investment, excuse me, the largest investment you own.
And it's interesting to note, and it's so appropriate that Wall Street Journal, in a piece about home values in metro markets around the country, the only metro market in America where the median home price declined in the first quarter, year over year. Guess.
Springfield, Illinois.
Yes.
I drove through there on Sunday, too.
And you saw my tweet.
I saw your tweet, too, but I did drive through. That I had no idea. I mean, I've been there a few times over the past 20 years, but it's...
Point is this. How
not well taken care of, that town.
How appropriate is it that the capital city of the worst governed state in America features the only metro market where home values actually declined year over year in the first quarter of this year? To paraphrase Milton Friedman, if you put Illinois state government in charge of the Sahara Desert in 5 years, it would be short on sand.
That was also part of Dan Proft's tweet.
So the Ben Bradley report, this 3% bump for politicians that they gave themselves in 1989, which persisted until 2003, 3% that compounds, like these 3% COLAs that have been compounding for all workers, public sector workers, for generations, even when up until the Biden administration, for the last 20 years, inflation had been about a seventh of that 3% COLA, cost of living adjustment bump, that compounds. It's an annuity, wasn't a COLA. 3% bump for politicians like Madigan, like Dillard, like Dan Rutherford. Across the political spectrum, the bipartisan combine, as our friend John Cass would call it.
Madigan is benefiting from a little-known perk passed back in 1989 that allowed he and other state lawmakers to bank 3% pension payment increases after reaching age 55 or meeting other criteria.
They're going to earn more in pensions than they did when they were working.
A 3% bump may sound small, but over time, for politicians like Madigan, who spent 50 years in office, it adds up to a lot, juicing his pension by 75% to $148,000 a year, which is $51,000 more than he made his last year in office.
If he lives till 90, he's going to collect more than $2 million in pensions.
Compared to a total of $1.1 million he would have received without the bump.
A million more. That's Sheila Weinberg, from a friend from Truth in Accounting. A million bucks more on the 3% bump if he lives to age 90, which is only for him about 15 years away. 148 grand in retirement. I mean, I know that's a pittance for, as compared to what Madigan was able to earn leveraging his position as Speaker of the House for his property tax appeals firm. But nonetheless, 150 grand while retired, that sounds like a pretty good deal. Who wants to raise their hand for that?
That's why the politicians arrange it for themselves.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-3636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And it's not just Madigan, as I mentioned. Channel 9 went through and identified some four dozen legislators that are enjoying the same benefit. And Barbara Flynn Curry, a longtime Hyde Park leftist, she actually was willing to speak on camera about her pension and the bump that she enjoys. And
really?
There's a great money line here. See if you can catch it.
We identified 40 other former lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle who are benefiting from the same pension pop. They include John Cullerton, Kirk Dillard, Emile Jones Jr.
From the perspective of the consumer, the constituent, the taxpayer. Yeah.
And this longtime state rep from Hyde Park.
And I certainly didn't expect to stay nearly as long as I did.
Oh, sure.
She said at the time the perk was passed, lawmakers' pension benefits maxed out at 20 years. But if they stayed in office, they still contributed to the pension fund without receiving any additional benefit.
And I think there was a sense that that really wasn't quite fair.
Lawmakers voted to end the perk for new reps and senators in 2003, in part because the state's pension debts were piling up.
So all of a sudden, the system that looked pretty healthy began to look pretty anemic. It's a tough problem. It's a tough issue. But I don't feel as if I've done anything wrong when I collect my pension benefit.
Did Barbara Flynn Curry do anything wrong? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Did she do anything wrong? Maybe she didn't. I mean, she was the policymaker, too. She's not just a passive recipient. It's really something in Illinois. And it's why Sheila Weinberg had this to say. Sheila Weinberg from Truth Accounting had this to say about the state of affairs.
I do not, unfortunately, even though I live in Illinois, I don't have hope for Illinois.
Wow. Even though I live in Illinois, I don't have hope.
Yeah, well, she's hardly alone. Half the state wants to leave. I wonder why. You just can't get people. It's remarkable to me. I put this to the test back in 2018. And failed the test. I thought maybe if people understood that their home was being liquidated to underwrite somebody else's guaranteed pension and somebody else that in large measure provided very little return on value for the decimation of your home value. I thought maybe like a taking by the government of your home would animate some people. I mean, it animates some, but would be a majoritarian issue. Say, well, people would be stoked to revolt and say, well, we have to change this. If there's one thing we can agree on, it's this. You just can't steal people's homes, redistribute the value of my home to somebody else to underwrite their guaranteed seven-figure pension. That's not right. It's not right for people making 55 grand a year to be on the hook for somebody else's guaranteed six-figure really, net present value, seven-figure pension. It's not right when, you know, I'd have to put in $1.3 million to get guaranteed $2 million back in a 401k. I mean, likely. Whereas teachers and cops and firefighters are putting 140 grand in to get guaranteed $2 million back. Guaranteed, regardless of market fluctuation. That's not right. And you're going to steal my home on top of it to finance that scheme? That doesn't seem right. We should do something about that.
And what's happened since 2018?
What happened in 2018 when that was put to the test is people said, no, it's okay. And what's happened since is people have said, no, it's okay. Okay. All right. I mean, I was just asking. I'm surprised by the answer, but I was just asking, so that's fine. Don Moffitt is a downstate Republican, retired. He was a real tool of the teachers union, but he's portrayed in this story as something of I wouldn't say hero, but really doing something good, recognizing how unfair this is. And it's not true. But, you know, again, you can only expect so much from network affiliate news. It's a miracle they tackle this issue at all.
It shouldn't be there. This is public service.
It, as in the pension perk, which boosted former Republican state rep Don Moffitt's payments by 15%.
Keep in mind, when I started, the state was in pretty good fiscal shape. I was a high school ag teacher.
Not so when he left office in 2018, which is one of the reasons Moffitt took the unusual step of asking to return his pension increase to the state.
Wow.
They said they'd never had anyone ask that before.
So instead, each year, he donates the extra amount he receives and then some to charities and other local nonprofits in and around his hometown.
If giving it back to the state would help, we would do that. But we think it would help more people directly.
Hashtag Don Moffitt. That's nice that he donates.
No, it's not. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. He is disgusting. He was a terrible legislator. He was a tool of the public sector unions. And now he's going to be portrayed as, oh, there's somebody giving back. Giving back? Give back the whole thing. It's a part-time job. How do you have a guaranteed pension? Do you have a guaranteed pension for your part-time job? Not to mention, do you make 75 grand a year to work half the year?
And also, he said he's a former teacher. I'm sure he's getting a teacher's pension, too.
There should be no pensions. But again, Republicans, the bipartisan combine, can see their way fit to make that an identifying trademark of the Republican Party here, just like they can't stop taking campaign cash from those same public sector unions. And this is a problem for so-called conservative legislators downstate as much as it is for these suburban p-hat hacks that masquerade as Republicans. It's despicable. Oh, and by the way, this Barbara Flynn Curry, Don Moffitt, well, you know, back in the day, the state was in pretty good financial shape. Right. And then you set up a Ponzi scheme that guaranteed it could no longer be in good financial shape. This is what actuaries do. They say this benefits package you're about to unfurl is going to cost X amount over this period of time. It's going to scale up at a 45-degree angle, you're not going to be able to afford it without doing X, Y, and Z, and that's where we're at. This whole, like, babe in the woods, golly, we didn't know what we were doing. Things were great then, and then all of a sudden we got $150 billion in unfunded pension liabilities. Who could have seen that coming? Anybody. Everybody. But it's fine. It's fine if, they take somebody's home in Galesburg to pay for Don Moffitt's frickin' pension. No problem. This is a smart state. Don and McHenry.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Yeah, this is just it's so aggravating, Dan, and I can hear your voice, and it, just what you just said just blows me away. It's like, it was great when we got here. It's terrible now, but I'm entitled to this pension, so it's just one of those things. It's the reason next time I call you, might be Don from Dallas, not Don from McHenry.
There you go.
Get
Thanks,
out.
Thanks, Don.
Good.
Yeah. It was great when I got here. Then I ensured that it wasn't going to be great when I left here, but I still get mine. Heroic. Thank you so much.
Hashtag Don Moffitt.
Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. My former state rep, Joe Lyons of the Lyons-LaVar clan, He had a state rep position, is getting that nice juicy pension. In addition to his full-time job as director of training with the County of Cook, which he gets a pension for too. He's making about 160, 170 grand a year now doing nothing.
And we're happy to pay it. And we're happy to stake our home to make sure Joe Lyons continues to live the life he's become accustomed to on our dime. Welcome to Illinois.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Over the last week, we've brought you a number of the CIA's new recruitment videos. Talked to our friend Jim Carafano about them earlier this week. All identitarianism all the time. I was born in a southern town and I'm gay. I'm a Latino woman. I'm this, I'm that.
I'm a cisgender woman who works, who could change a diaper with one hand and coddle a crying toddler with the other. I am woman, hear me roar.
Right. There's a, definitely a Helen Reddy element to the female stories. There's also this sort of is a nice extension of the Obama years. Remember Julia?
Which one was she? That's not Pajama Boy's girlfriend, is it?
No, but she was equally fictional.
Oh, Julia.
She was the composite.
Yeah,
like she was a graphic artist in her mid-30s with a kid, and she was gender fluid, and she was, 15% of all the approved ethnicities and so on and so forth. And interestingly, of course, Julia, character from 1984. But nonetheless, so that was a composite. You know, like Obama's girlfriends. There's just a composite. And so now we have actual human beings who are basically nothing more than composites. That's how they define themselves, as their non-behavioral characteristics. I'm not an actual three-dimensional person. I don't have any sapience. I'm just an amalgamation of my non-behavioral characteristics. And that's why I joined the CIA. Or the Army. Be all you can be? Oh, that's a bygone. That's from a bygone era. Don't expect that coming back anytime soon. Let me introduce you to the Army's recruitment video and the story of Emma.
This is the story of a soldier who operates your nation's Patriot missile defense systems. It begins in California, with a little girl raised by two moms. Although I had a fairly typical childhood, took ballet, played violin, I also marched for equality. I like to think I've been defending freedom from an early age.
Little social justice warrior.
When I was 6 years old, one of my moms had an accident that left her paralyzed. Doctors said she might never walk again. But she tapped into my family's pride to get back on her feet, eventually standing at the altar to marry my other mom. With such powerful role models, I finished high school at the top of my class and then attended UC Davis, where I joined a sorority full of other strong women. But as graduation approached, I began feeling like I'd been handed so much in life, a sorority girl stereotype. Sure, I'd spent my life around inspiring women, but what had I really achieved on my own? One of my sorority sisters was studying abroad in Italy. Another was climbing Mount Everest. I needed my own adventures, my own challenge. And after meeting with an Army recruiter, I found it. A way to prove my inner strength and maybe shatter some stereotypes along the way. I'm U.S. Army Corporal Emma Malone Lord, and I answered my calling.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-360-A, turnkey.pro text line. I didn't know gay pride could cure paralysis. My mom had a neck injury that left her paralyzed. She tapped into our family's pride, and she was cured.
And she was able to stand up at the altar to marry her other mom.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Propaganda, that's what this is. I hope she was a Kappa. She, when she was in her sorority, does it show, was she a DG or maybe a tri-delt, Dan? Does it say?
I don't know. I just know it was a bunch of independent women who went on to Mount Everest and do all sorts of other amazing things. UC Davis sorority girls known for.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Tackling big challenges.
How about the position that she takes, too, and that the Army tacitly endorses? I've been fighting for freedom from an early age, and because I fought, because I was roped into, I don't know, marching with my two moms to redefine marriage. Is that freedom? Is that what the Army's in the business of doing? Fighting for the redefinition of marriage? That doesn't strike you as problematic.
I'm watching old Army recruitment videos from the 80s and 90s here. They used to show men and women on the battlefield actually fighting where there's not a political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't they go back to that?
Mm-hmm.
Be all you can be.
Right, because as been saying for years, again, you think that there will be any institution in society insulated from all this. Won't come for me. Won't come for institutions I revere that I am or was a part of, like the military. Right. How about now? What do you think? She's in charge of the nation's, well, in charge of, but she's part
Patriot of Missile Defense System.
Yeah. Just like the CIA folks that are all, you know, walking around Langley, navel gazing, celebrating their non-behavioral characteristics, celebrating their activism and their social justice disposition, just like Emma is here. And it's fine. I mean, obviously there are going to be people with different political views in the military. No problem. People are different. But this is about instituting a particular culture that crowds out that diversity of viewpoint. And it also, I would suggest, and we've heard from people like Carafano, who's West Point grad, you know, 30 years in the military, that it's pretty bad for cohesion and morale, the sort of preemptive divisiveness within the ranks. If I was in the military, and I'm sure there are people in the military that have my attitude, you know, I'm not going to be preached to by Emma about the redefinition of marriage being a synonym for freedom, for fighting for freedom. This is something that enhances our national security, our military preparedness. Same question as we had with the CIA. It's curious, I think.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And as we know, down come the standards. 44% of female enlistees failing the combat readiness physical test, as reported this week. We mentioned it yesterday. We've talked about the effort to politicize elite units like Army Rangers to get women in, but they can't make the physical requirements. Most men couldn't either, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, are there standards that you have to meet, because we need people meeting those standards in order to have the most effective service, branch of the military service, most effective units, most effective soldiers, most effective CIA analysts and other employees at CIA. But, you know, you start to get in the business of standards, and then you know what you're doing all of a sudden. You're talking about merit. And merit has no place in 21st century America, private sector or public sector.
Is anybody embarrassed by this? I mean, people that used to serve, too, in the Army? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
It's ironic because this recruitment video comes amid more than 120 retired U.S. generals and admirals signing an open letter warning that the United States is embroiled in an existential fight and urged all citizens to get involved in local and state politics. We are in a fight for our survival as a constitutional republic like no other time since our founding in 1776. It is a conflict between supporters of socialism and Marxism versus supporters of constitutional freedom and liberty. Signed by 124 former military leaders, released by the organization Flag Officers for America. Yeah. And they mention election integrity, China. They should mention what's going on in the military ranks themselves to put a fine point on it. Signatories of the letter, notable ones include retired Army Brigadier General Donald Bolduc, who is a Senate candidate in New Hampshire, retired Army Lieutenant General William Boykin, retired Vice Admiral John Poindexter, DNSA for President Reagan, of course. Nate in Schiller Park.
Yeah, hey, Dan, Amy, good morning to both of you. How are you?
Morning.
Hi.
Okay, so here's my comment. Basically, 12 years, I was in the Army. I got medically retired, thank God, because listening to that video made my stomach turn. Here's the funny thing. If you have a college degree and the Army recruits you, you pretty much go in as an officer. She identified as being enlisted and not an officer, which just goes to show how intelligent she really is, and she clearly couldn't pass the officer candidate.
Interesting, yeah. Oh, good catch. Thanks for the call, Nate. And, boy, that's shocking, UC Davis, because I understand everybody who graduates from UC Davis, the females at least, are all Mensa members who are accomplishing great feats immediately after graduation.
Scaling mountains, Dan.
Stylized. You know, stylized. It's a recruitment video. Yeah, it takes some literary license. Sure. No problem. Joe in Naperville.
You know, two quick points. You know, she doesn't have to know how to fight or anything like that, because all she's going to have to do is call a social worker to come and de-escalate any kind of situation she's in. And for those that think that this is a good idea, think about the Dirty Harry movie where the recruit was being asked, you know, the guy's got a gun. He's got a gun. He's got a hostage. What are you going to do? And she's fumbling for words. Harry just walks up, puts two fingers up, and pretends he shoots the guy. He goes, case closed.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Yeah, social workers, that's a good idea. Send them to the front lines and deploy a battalion of social workers to
unarmed social workers.
Middle East. Well, yeah, obviously. Yeah, well, obviously unarmed.
Well, I'm just letting you know.
Yeah, you don't want anybody hurt.
We should mention, too, that this is not, it's in, that Emma's story is not a real person. Right? I mean, it's in a cartoon.
No.
No, this is a real.
Yeah. Oh. It's a real person.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Joe in Hoffman Estates. I mean, it's stunning that's a real person, but that's an actual person.
Okay, it's an actual person, but I'm saying they're not showing pictures of her when she was a kid. They're showing, it's like a cartoon of her life.
Yeah, and then, you know, fast forwards. Yeah, that's right. Joe in Hoffman Estates, sorry.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning, guys. I was wondering, I'm in a business where I deal with a lot of different people, and if anything like this ever comes up, everyone figures it's pretty much nuts.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what percentage of people actually believe in this, or are they just going against the grain? I don't even get it.
Well, it's a good question, Joe, but it points up the larger issue, right? It's probably a minority of people that look at this and say, isn't that wonderful? All of this identitarian silliness, and yet it marches on because the people who see this and just quietly shake their head and move along, they're not challenging this when it becomes part of corporate culture, school culture, college culture, American culture. You have to speak up so people know that it's okay to speak up, number one. And number two, that, you know, oh, it's interesting. Joe from Hoffman Estates also thinks this is insanity. That's helpful. Joe from Hoffman Estates also went to the school board and told a nutty school board that their race equity bilge is unacceptable for his students. Yeah, maybe we should rally around that. Maybe we should get new school board members. Maybe we should get new mayors. Maybe we should get new legislators. Maybe we should get new statewide officials. Maybe we should get new Congress peoples.
Well, I could tell you, Emma's mom, who had the neck injury in this little vignette here, looks a lot like Lori Lightfoot's wife, the first lady of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just a reminder, history always changed, good or bad, by the committed few. And the identitarian left is committed, and they have institutional control. So whether or not, you know, you come into contact with people and you talk about this Army recruitment video and you both roll your eyes and say, isn't that silly? And then you get about your day. Well, they are moving on. They don't care that you think it's nonsense. Amish texter in Huntley.
Uh-oh.
Rare call from the Amish texter.
Yeah, well, it's only because I figured out the name of that sorority of Emma with two mamas.
What is
Mama Ate a Pie.
Thanks for the call, Amish.
Wow.
Janice in Naperville. Just walk past
okay,
it.
Okay, just...
walk past it. Don't pay any attention to
I'm
it.
I'm trying not to.
Janice in Naperville.
Yeah, I'm a 70-year-old grandmother, and I was in the Air Force Reserves back in the day. But I am very embarrassed about these recruitment videos. And I feel bad for these guys and women who have, like, served overseas and have really sacrificed and had to rise above this silliness that's going on now.
Thank you for the call, Janice. Appreciate that perspective.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine has come up with the perfect ploy for the COVID enthusiast.
It's so good.
The state of Ohio will give away $1 million prizes to five adults and another five full-ride public college scholarships to teens who get vaccinated, he said on Wednesday.
Yeah, scholarships to state universities, including tuition, room and board and books.
Full ride. Cha-ching. Public college.
I know. I mean, this is a big... I'd like to move to Ohio and get my kids vaccinated again.
Really?
And this is great. And a lot also. And for the adults, you know, you can't leave them out. Yeah, every week, he's for the next 5 weeks, if you get vaccinated, your number goes into a lottery system. And then they pull out a winner. And the money is coming out of federal coronavirus relief funds.
Mm-hmm.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. In Pennsylvania, Tom Wolf there, the governor, said if 70% of the people in his state get vaccinated, their reward is no more mask mandates.
Mm-hmm. West Virginia, that's a lot better than West Virginia's $100 savings bond for 16 to 35-year-olds, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's perfect ploy, right? So is this something that would, if you were recalcitrant on the vaccination, would galvanize you to get vaccinated? Oh, why do you think I said it's the perfect ploy for the COVID enthusiast?
Would this incentivize you, Dan, to get vaccinated if you have a chance of winning $1 million?
No. You know why?
Why?
Because I can process odds. Perfect lottery for the vaccination. It's perfect. It's perfect for the person who cannot process odds, who cannot process numbers. And that's the COVID enthusiast.
Bingo. Right.
I mean, it's positively cynical, dressed up as fun. But of course, taking advantage of people who are terrible at math. Terrible at risk assessments, risk reward assessments. Of course.
They're living in fear.
Throw a lottery at it. Look how well it's done for funding K-12 education in Illinois. The entire state bought that line in the 80s.
Yeah.
Why not throw another lottery at the problem? I love it. Would it get
Mike
me
DeWine
to take the vaccine? I don't know. I guess if the risk reward of taking the vaccine is more risk than reward, then why would I take the vaccine for the risk-reward of winning $1 million and the odds associated?
Mike DeWine said, I know that some of you are shaking your head and saying that Mike DeWine, he's crazy. But this million-dollar drawing idea isn't a waste of money. That the point is that the vaccines are available and people need to take them in order to get our lives back to normal.
Yeah, I know. It's the same pat right. line. So what? The question is making an assessment on that statement. So what's the assessment? What's the assessment? What do we know about the COVID risk to, let's start with 12 to 15-year-olds since they're, you know.
It starts today.
They can get involved. They can, you know, get into the Powerball for a college scholarship in Ohio. What do we know? Why would you get your 12 to 15-year-old vaccinated based on the risk-reward of COVID versus the vaccine?
So they always say, so you don't kill grandma. You don't get it at school and spread it to elderly people. But if your elderly grandma or mom don't have the vaccine by now.
There's no evidence, at least according to one Dr. Alan Moy, we played yesterday, that the vaccine prevents transmission. I know this is repeated all the time. It was repeated in the New York Times in a story. Epidemiologists are starting to hug again. Yeah. A majority of surveyed epidemiologists said they would not attend small indoor dinner parties, ride the subway, or take a vacation, even by car, today.
Oh, my God. Well, they're germaphobes.
Yeah, and these are the people who are providing the advice and counsel to federal and state officials who are then turning around with their fear-mongering. And the epidemiologists provide cover for the politicians. Because they're fearful, they provide cover for the politicians' fear-mongering. Not to mention the politicians are generally ignorant. They can't process numbers either. So it's really amazing, the survey, what epidemiologists are doing now. Scheer saying they had done or would have done the following activities if necessary in the last 30 days. Attend a sporting event or concert or play. Only 6%. Attend a wedding or funeral, only 10%. Exercise at a gym or fitness studio, 15%. Worked in a shared office, 23%. Travel by airplane, 25%. Ate indoors at a restaurant, 30%. Tony Fauci won't either.
No, St.
Fauci,
won't.
The oracle of COVID. And those attitudes are informing the policy choices being made and the lives people are being allowed to live. But hey, don't worry about that. Because you got a chance at $1 million. You rubes. That's what they think. Are they right? John in Crown Point.
Hi, Dan. How you doing?
Good.
Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Yeah, Dan, I think you should get that shot.
Why is that?
Why not? I think you're a little scared.
why not? You should do something.
What? Because,
why? Why not? Because I'm not afraid of the COVID virus, and to the extent that I would get infected, that's the best way to achieve T cell immunity. So bring it on. That's why.
I bet you already got the shot and didn't tell anybody.
I bet you're wrong.
No, he didn't get it.
I bet you're wrong.
Didn't you take a day off? Couple weeks ago?
Yeah, to play golf.
No, you really got vaccinated.
You think I'm taking a day off to get vaccinated?
You got vaccinated. I know he did.
I got an idea.
All right, John.
Would you get vaccinated if it meant around at Augusta?
No.
Oh, come on.
No.
With Condoleezza Rice?
No.
Ah!
No. You're not going to like bribe me into doing something
you,
that doesn't
yes.
make sense. No.
But if we get 70%, our kids can go back to school normally Monday
please.
Through Friday. No, that's true.
You can get involved with the extortionists. I already did. I know. I don't pay off extortionists. That's your choice.
I was with my pediatrician yesterday, and I said, well, you know, what advice do you have? Because I know parents that want you to write an exemption letter because they don't want to get their kids vaccinated. And he said, I'm not doing that because there was a study. 2,200 kids were involved. Half received placebo. So out of the 1,100, not one allergic reaction to the vaccine, and it's safe and blah, 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 blah. And so everyone's worried about reproductive and, you know, menstruation periods, all that stuff. But he said it doesn't affect it, and I'm telling you it's safe.
Who's he?
My pediatrician.
So what?
Because this is between me and my doctor and not my governor telling me I have to get vaccinated.
Yeah, well, that's fine. But your pediatrician has no more knowledge than anybody else does. Did he do clinical trials?
No, he just read information about the clinical trial.
Yeah, I can read information about it, too. Well, so what?
He's telling me that it's safe.
I know. But do you participate in the conversations on this show?
I do.
Do you pay attention to the guests we have?
I do.
Yeah, well, then, so what he's telling you? That's one viewpoint. I understand it. The evidence suggests, based on what we know right now, which is very incomplete, it's safe. Very incomplete. And provides a low level of protection, as Dr. Alan Moy detailed at his in his talk at the Union League Club. And this becomes a rinse and repeat. But you don't know. And again, even though it's highly likely that you will not have an adverse outcome, for somebody who is under 18, it is more likely that you'll suffer from taking the vaccine than you will from being infected with COVID. So given that, why would you subject your 12 to 18 year old to the vaccine based on incomplete knowledge about the vaccine with more complete knowledge about the risk associated with COVID to that person? Because that's the actual analysis. Ask your pediatrician that. That's the actual conversation, not is it generally safe as compared to what? That's the question. Andy in Hinsdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. It's like Thursday morning zoo there today.
Yeah.
Funny show so far. This program in Ohio is a great example of how governments waste money when you start throwing these federal funny money funds around, right? $1 million for five people. I mean, I have a much cheaper way to get people to get vaccinated in Ohio. The state of Ohio should offer them all the COVID enthusiasts. You can get your vaccination record tattooed on your forehead. And with your vaccination, it costs $50 a person. You can get the whole state inoculated. And then they all self-identify, so we know which idiots are doing it.
I like that. Yeah, I like that. Thanks for the call, Andy.
A face tattoo?
No, a free tattoo.
Free tattoo.
Yeah. So, but you have to have it somewhere that's visible so everybody can see what a good person you are. Makes sense. Tom and Elgin. Hey, Tom.
Tom.
Hey, good morning. Recently had an employee come to us after we had a COVID case on a crew and say, and we usually send them all home, get them tested, go through all the protocol. But he said, well, I've been vaccinated. And so I'm like, okay, that's interesting. So I don't have to send you home. So I went for guidance on this, and I was told you're considered fully vaccinated 2 weeks after the second shot and for up to 3 months.
Right.
So what happens after 3 months?
Mm-hmm. 3 months? I thought it was six months to a year.
That's part of the nobody knows. 6 months is what I've heard, too, but nobody knows. I mean, thanks for the call,
Tom. I know somebody's gotten vaccinated twice, and 2 months later she got COVID.
You mean got vaccinated with the two shots.
Yeah. Has a compromised immune system and got COVID, but she didn't have to go to the hospital. She was fine. It was a minor cold. And her doctor told her that had she not gotten the vaccine, her symptoms would have been worse.
Well,
and she could have been hospitalized.
Well, probably so, but he doesn't know. That's just guesswork. How could he possibly know that? He doesn't know. But yes, we know.
But she's part of a case study now.
We know the vaccine will mute the impact of the infection for most people who get it after vaccination. And it's a small percentage of people who've gotten the vaccinations,
right, so
that have been reinfected.
That's why they're all over
2%. No, it's more. It's like 0.2%. It's very, very small. It's like 9,000 out of 95 million.
Okay.
But, I mean, Marty Makary, Johns Hopkins, to repeat it again, get the vaccine, wait 14 days, resume normal life. But that's not what they're saying. What's the command from Jelly Belly here? Get vaccinated, we reopen on June 11th, and then you wear masks for the rest of your life.
Yeah, for the rest of your life. And he wants people to come, drive Illinois, come to Illinois for your summer plans. They're not going to come here if there's a mask mandate. It's going to drive them away.
Mike in Union.
Hey, good morning. Hey, you know, Governor DeWine is the perfect reason why this country's so screwed up. I want to make a prediction that 3 out of 5 of the winners in this lottery will be identitarians. And how soon will Governor Pritzker, our great governor, decide to up the ante and maybe do the same program in our state? This is wonderful stuff, isn't it?
It is.
Thank I'll you. Ask Thanks, him that Mike. Today when he goes to Great America. Yippee!
Yeah.
Wee!
Yeah.
Great America's open.
Is he going to go on any of the rides?
He might. What?
I hope there's engineers on site to make sure the rides can handle that sort of load.
We need a structural engineer.
We've got a person of size who wants to go on the tidal wave. Is that still there?
No. Oh. But there's another roller coaster there. Place of the You know what?
Is the demon still there?
Yeah.
Is the American Eagle still there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love the American Eagle. My favorite's the Viper, though. You know what? I don't know if he could fit on a ride. And you know what? I'm being really rude right now.
It's not rude. He's just a person of size, and we're just trying to see if you can get a square person into a square hole. Yeah, it's just a question. Mike on the north side. Mike.
Hey, Mike. Hey.
Hey, good morning.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes. We can hear you. How are you?
Hey, watch out. Pritzker went to Oak Street Beach last summer. He left the ring around Lake Michigan. The Army Corps of Engineers are still cleaning it up. Amy, how old are you that you're still going to a pediatrician?
How old am I that
I'm
still
your son, because he's like 6'7", 270 pounds. He looks like Jethro Boateng in kindergarten sitting on those little chairs. But I wanted to say the city came up with a program that's going to give a free pension to everyone who gets the shot.
There you go.
They tried to explain that they are right for the city would run out of money.
Mike, we have a crazy line with you.
You're cutting out, but I got it. The free city pension with the vaccination. That's
yeah,
a good one.
That's a good one, yeah.
Bill in Monticello.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I heard your conversation yesterday about Dr. Moy, and I was interested enough to go find it on YouTube myself. It's there. I don't know for how long because he goes against the conventional wisdom.
Right.
But the money shot is at time point 38 minutes, which has the chart of who should and who should not get the vaccine. And your discussion yesterday left out my age group, which is 70. And I went and looked at the chart. He basically recommends, you know, if you're 70 and healthy, maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. And, you know, there's therapeutics out there. He mentions ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. Mm-hmm. So I encourage everybody to go look at that chart. It's at minute point 38 in his talk. It's very interesting.
Yeah, this is, thanks for the call, Bill. Just for more context here, we discussed it yesterday, mentioned it here in the conversation. Dr. Alan Moy, who's a pulmonologist, he's the head of research at the John Paul Institute in John Paul II Institute in Iowa. And he gave a talk to Catholic Citizens of Illinois at the Union League Club a couple of weeks ago. And he went through a whole presentation on vaccinations and all other aspects of COVID, but it was a real nice primer on the science of virology, both in terms of infection and vaccine. And again, he basically recommended against vaccinations for anyone under 50 and healthy.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Jason Riley writing in the Wall Street Journal, classroom chaos in the name of racial equity is a bad lesson plan. And he talks about specifically physical safety of students or racial balance in school suspension rates. Which is more important, the physical safety of students or racial balance in school suspension rates? In New York, L.A. and Chicago, reductions in suspensions and expulsions were followed by an uptick in bullying and other disruptive behavior. Students and teachers alike have reported feeling less safe. Fighting, gang activity, and drug use have increased. A 2018 study of schools in Wisconsin found that softer discipline policies pushed by the Obama administration are having a negative impact on student test scores. He continues, does Riley. The sad irony is that black students, in whose name this was done, were the ones most hurt by racial quotas and school discipline. A 2017 federal survey of school safety by the National Center for Education Statistics found that 25% of black students nationwide reported being bullied, the highest percentage of any racial or ethnic group. The Trump administration tried to reverse this focus on equity, equal outcomes, balance, rather than physical safety. And now, of course, that's being reversed yet again to go back to the Obama-era approach under, well, as part of the Joe Obama third term. Well, so it's the same. So that's one aspect. This is not so much the aspect of racial equity and the indoctrination in school systems in the suburbs, but it just is indicative of the multi-layered problems that these equity programs produce. And so we know Chicago. We spent a lot of time on Chicago. We need to start spending more time on the suburbs. So here's another case study. St. Charles District 303, where the board in St. Charles District 303, another one of those places that used to be center-right, used to be commonsensical, and completely gave over to the Marxists. I mean, I think they technically have a Republican state senator, former mayor of St. Charles, who's terrible. Terrible. Hack. Surrender Republican. Useless. And they like it. And they like District 303. They're a great school district. You know, St. Charles is a well-heeled area. So they were able to spend $5,000 on a deep equity program. That's what it's called, deep equity. Well, at the most recent board meeting, some people spoke out against the deep equity program, including a third grade teacher in District 303.
Our union president went in front of the board advocating for this program, saying that we engaged with our membership, our teachers, and our staff who are overwhelmingly in support of this program and excited for the new opportunity. Personally, I do not know a single teacher who fully understands this program, myself included, or is behind this program. Voting on a program 4-3 with one member asking to table the vote seems irresponsible. I recall in one of the board meetings that somebody asked for a copy of the workbook before voting, and last I heard, Warren did not provide one. As an elementary school teacher, I take pride in the fact that I teach equity, inclusion, and why it is important to be different each and every year. My students do not yet see color. They are 8. The director of this new program will be compensated between $115,000 and $150,000, mixed in the high school leaders for the YES program and workbooks for teachers, and we are talking $230,000 to $260,000. From my understanding, the district and the taxpayers are already struggling, so my question is, where is this extra money coming from? I understand that deep equity is a teacher training program. However, there is no need for politics to drive the educational process. Rather, a culture for excellence should be promoted. The deep equity process demands every minority must be treated individually because they are all different. There is no recognition of a common bond as Americans. This causes more divide in our community as well as in our schools. And what does this deep equity program suggest teachers do to help students of color learn reading, writing, and math? Absolutely nothing. It only teaches the teachers to check their white privilege through quizzes, workbook pages, and very demeaning readings and comments. It ignores education and advises teachers that racism is the reason their non-white students cannot read, write, add, subtract, etc. Additionally, deep equity claims that the differences in academic performance have nothing to do with the culture or effort, yet are purely based on the product of racism.
Lastly, this program. Your time is up.
Mm-hmm.
And Thank you. Never want to hear from you again.
Maybe at some point the time will be up for those board members. Maybe at some point the community will say that the time is up for this nonsense. I understand there's a school board member at District 303 in St. Charles named Ed McNally, who actually is also a Proviso public school teacher, who inquired about rescinding the deep equity contract. Oh, it's interesting. So he's in a majority-minority school district, unlike St. Charles. the school board member, McNally. And he's opposed to this. Gosh, I wonder what he knows, having to teach students that are disproportionately disadvantaged in a school district like Proviso, as opposed to these sentimental barbarians and their kids in St. Charles. I wonder what he knows, what he understands about the intellectual poison that are these programs. Parent was there, too. How about that? Parent showed up. Good. Mitch Bridges is his name. He moved away from Naperville to St. Charles to get away from doing what they were doing in Naperville, which is exactly this. And now he's got to move again. But here's the problem. You can't outrun it. You can't. I mean, and I'm not blaming Mr. Bridges, but it's just a lesson. You will not be able to outrun this. At some point, you're going to run out of options and you're going to have to stand and fight or submit.
This push for equity, in my mind, as a parent of students in D303, is nothing more than another convoluted way to force racist thinking and behavior on our children and in our schools. And it needs to be rejected immediately. We are all equal, all of us. We moved to St. Charles to be a part of the great schools here, but this discussion of treating some students differently based on the color of their skin has us seriously questioning our decision, and even has us seriously considering moving out of the district. If there are teachers treating children differently based on the color of their skin, with more detentions or more suspensions, we should investigate that on an individual basis separately, and if needed, remove them from the classroom. There's no place for racism in our schools, either by a single perpetrator or by or elected school board forcing it upon our children under the guise of equity. We've been through this already as a nation. It doesn't work when you treat people differently based on how they look. Why are you bringing us backwards? And how many signatures, actual question, how many signatures would I have to bring from the community to get you to re-vote and remove this?
How difficult is it to say that to school board members, to teachers, to administrators, to college professors, to HR directors, to C-suite executives? How difficult it is to say that, what Mitch Bridges just said? Is that so challenging? Does that take some extraordinary courage? Why do you want to take us back to a racist era when we treated people differently based on their race? This is the same message that New York City prep school math teacher Paul Rossi had. Why are you telling me that I have to treat my students differently based on their race? Who wants that? And frame the question exactly so. Raise your hand if you think people, students, should be treated differently based on their race. That's what you want to do?
What's segregation?
It's, I mean, well it's no a, race it's a racial
or sex.
Order.
Well, I know, but no race or sex is inherently superior to any other race or sex.
Yeah, but that's not
it's
the question.
Pitting people against each other. Well, yeah, people should be brave and raise their hands and say no.
Why should people be treated differently based on their race? Why are you promoting that? Why do you want to take us back to a Jim Crow-like era? It's not. It's softer. It's a softer form of racism than Jim Crow, but it is on that continuum. It's a racial order. You think that helps? Who does it help? Who are you helping? You're helping minority students? What evidence do you have to show that this helps minority students? Has anybody ever asked that question? These doctrinal seminars have been around for a while now. What evidence do you have to show that it helps minority employees in your business? Prove it. No? Not interested? Making people produce evidence? And as I said before, oh, that's interesting. Deep equity. Oh, okay. Well, if we're going to go forward with this too, then we need to expand the curriculum to include voices like John McWhorter's or Bob Woodson or Ian Rowe so many others, right? Because why wouldn't we? We want to have this important discussion about race. Why wouldn't we include them? Is that so difficult to ask?
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
This is 60 Seconds of Sanity with Dan Proft. The timer starts now.
While the opposition to the intellectual poison that is critical race theory is appreciated, conservative governors moving to prohibit such instruction from K through 12 curricula could be making a mistake. The better play is for Paul's parents and students to pose two simple questions to teachers, professors, administrators, and HR officers. First, can we include John McWhorter's work in our discussion of race? And then, if not, why not? McWhorter, who has previously termed himself a cranky liberal Democrat, is a Columbia University linguistics professor who has penned detailed and devastating reviews of both White Fragility and How to Be an Anti-Racist, the two centerpieces for most current critical race theory doctrinal seminars. The left does subtraction. Conservatives should respond with addition. Do not banish your enemies from the arena of ideas. Vanquish them on the field of intellectual battle. Force the teachers to teach both sides. After all, who's afraid of John McWhorter?
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And on Friday, upon that surprising jobs report, surprising to people who believe that incentives don't matter, like the president, I asked our friend Scott the Cow Guy Shalady if it was now time to put all my money into Dogecoin. And he wouldn't answer my question because he would lose a number of licenses if he did answer
right.
the question. So we got to go somewhere else for that answer. And that somewhere else is Abe Froman Jr. He is the director of operations at Digital Asset Redemption, and he is our cryptocurrency expert. So it seems like after the hammering the market took yesterday and the inflationary pressure that's come from a combination of funny money and lockdowns, good time to do a stop, look, and listen on crypto. Abe, if that is your real name, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yes, it is not my real name, and I should say that last time I was on your show,
you had a different name.
No, that was two times ago.
Oh, okay.
But I actually faked my own dad out. He called me afterwards to make sure I was okay because he's like, I had somebody else on the radio this morning. I'm like, no, Dad, that was me. He's not seen the.
He didn't know you were the sausage king of Chicago.
No, and I'm no king. If you want a Bitcoin king, I can introduce you to him.
So let's talk about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be an inflation hedge. That's one of the attributes that is promoted. And yesterday, upon the market tanking on the news of higher inflation than anticipated, so did Bitcoin.
Correct. So why?
How's that an inflation hedge?
Well, it's not an inflation hedge minute to minute or day by day or week by week.
Okay.
But it is over a period of time. I mean, there are only 21 million Bitcoin. So when you're handing out trillions of dollars left and right, it's eventually going to chase and it's going to run the price up. And if you look at the price of Bitcoin, you see tremendous volatility. And some people love that and some people are afraid by it. But over time, the volatility is always up and to the left. Up and to the right.
Up and to the right, yeah, right.
But it's I asked people when we first started talking about it is look at it as a multi-year, even an intergenerational type of a investment / bet, whatever you want to call it. So treat it like your 401k. If you're 20 years old, just say like, I don't even care about this for 45 years. Cause if I sit there and watch the price go, up and down.
Yeah.
And there's interesting times too, where you'll see the price of Bitcoin will follow the S&P or the Dow. And then there's times that it decouples from it and there's no real rhyme or reason to it. It's the other thing to also understand is that Bitcoin is global. So people in South Korea don't care about what's going on in the United States when it comes to this kind of stuff. So you do get that decoupling motion happening from time to time.
And it is, so it is worth noting too, on the, just on the inflation score, since that's dominating the conversation right now. Unlike our fiat currency, the government can't inflate Bitcoin. It can't distort the value of Bitcoin, as that's a true market value.
Right.
And that's why it's a hedge.
Right. And that's where it's kind of like, you know, I never, when people say, how could Bitcoin be worth $55,000 or $49,000 or whatever it is this very second, I always ask people, why does it take $49,000 of your dollars to buy one Bitcoin? You know, it's really the same question. You just turn it inside out and you ask them the same question. It's like, well, you know, and people ask me, like, oh, who do you want to be president? I'm like, I don't care, because, you know, the Tea Party movement seems to be, you know, maybe dead forever, but the whole idea of monetary or fiscal discipline is, you know,
it's, yes.
So it doesn't really matter.
You're channeling Stanley Druckenmiller in the Journal this week.
Right.
With respect to Bitcoin, then, it seems to me one of the big problems is, and one of the reasons people are hesitant to place too much stock in it, literally and figuratively, is the network effect problem, right? People don't want to use it until people are using it. And it just took a hit yesterday with Elon Musk saying no more Bitcoin to buy, as a payment for Tesla.
Right.
How significant is that?
None.
Not significant.
Not significant at all. It may be significant for 36 hours or, you know, until the next news cycle's passed. But, you know, when I saw that stuff from Elon yesterday, I'm willing to put a one Bitcoin bet that he could not pass a drug test this morning.
Oh my God.
It just literally makes so little sense of why he was even putting out that tweet, which is why the market is going to bounce right back really quickly. So I put zero stock in Elon Musk's opinion about Bitcoin, because it's constantly moving. And you would think a guy like that would be super smart about technology. And maybe he is, but maybe he can't pass a drug test this morning, too.
Wow. Okay. How did you think he did on Saturday Night Live?
Was he hopped
up on drugs then, too? Adam Scott? Jim,
no.
Steve,
we,
drunk on Dogecoin. He
bashed Dogecoin about four times.
I tried to watch Saturday Night Live in order to prepare for this interview, and I just didn't get around to
it.
I'm sorry.
But
Dogecoin's down because of his appearance and what he...
Well, he just made a quip about it saying that, it's
four
a scam.
Times.
Right. So, it's a scam.
Yeah,
that's what he said.
It is. And, well, I shouldn't
is
say it
a
was
scam?
A scam. No, it was a joke. It was a dorm room experiment.
Right.
So a lot
like
of these
Facebook.
Exactly. But, I mean, we talked last year about Facebook coming out with this whole idea of Libra coin and all that. I'm like, I love the idea of Libra coin. I would never touch it. It's going to be a terrible failure. But it's going to get literally billions of people involved in understanding this ecosystem. And when it does fail, the lessons will be learned as to why it failed. And that is why Bitcoin is kind of king of the crypto markets, because it doesn't have personhood. You can't arrest the founder of Bitcoin. You can't confiscate Bitcoin. You can go to Coinbase and you can put Brian Armstrong in jail, and then you could freeze all the funds inside of Coinbase. But if you're holding your own Bitcoin, it's no different than cash in a way. It's really, really, it's essentially impossible to confiscate unless it's at the end of a gun.
Yeah, but getting beyond Elon Musk and talking about this network effect problem, it doesn't it have limited upside if people do not want to use it for commercial transactions?
Not with Bitcoin. And let me explain that. People talk about it, and I really don't like the word currency, digital currency. It can be that. But it's just tokenized, you know, units of value. And the nice thing is like Bitcoin, like with some of the stuff that I do with companies as we're doing pilot programs, it's like you might send $5 million to France in order to pay an invoice over a weekend, which you can do. And then they pay you back, you know, next week and try to settle. It takes days. And sometimes things get lost. And you have to ask yourself, like, how in our traditional financial system, and I know it's been built up over hundreds of years, and they've got layers and layers of technology and all these other things. Bitcoin doesn't have that. So it's interesting in my world to be able to witness how terribly inefficient and how terribly expensive the traditional financial market is when compared to Bitcoin. There's value there. There's value to be able to pay invoices quickly. There's a lot of value there, which doesn't involve, I'm not going to use it to buy, you know, gum at the gas station.
And what about two other aspects of this? One is just in terms of, again, for people that have viewed this from afar, I buy, you know, $5,000 worth of Bitcoin. So I buy a fraction of a Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Can I get in and out? So if it ticks up or if it ticks down and I want to take my profits or minimize my losses, I can get right in and right out seamlessly.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, the entire crypto space is not that much different than the traditional financial space, where it's just bots fighting against other bots.
And it's a direct conversion to dollars into my account.
Absolutely. You know, now it would take time to move those dollars from, say, like a Coinbase or a Gemini or Kraken into your Chase or BMO Harris account in order to actually spend it. But that's an ACH transfer, or, you know, so it's a couple days.
Okay.
And then you pay taxes on it, right?
Yes.
Well,
yes,
well,
and that's
like,
another
every transaction,
like any game.
Right.
But there's another cool thing that's happening.
Ooh, tell us.
Yes, I will.
Is this just in?
it probably is for most people, but okay. You look at the evolution of these ecosystems and these technologies, and you can start separating yourself from your own personhood. And the idea being is that I don't have to be a citizen of Illinois. I mean, I'm physically here. And I pay taxes here and all that, but I don't have to have my entire digital footprint or financial footprint to be in the United States or anywhere else.
Right.
And I'm only bringing this up to expand people's ideas around use cases, around intergenerational wealth transfer. What does that mean? And I'm sure most of your audience would be sympathetic to the idea that we're hearing about a war on cash. What happens when there's a war on wealth?
Absolutely. Well, what happened? There is.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, I think that's a fair point, and it's a good attribute to raise. No question.
It's a huge attribute, because think of it, you know, think 20, 30 years ago, people had Swiss bank accounts, but the only people that had them were the extremely wealthy.
Yeah.
Right now, when you cold store crypto, you have your own offshore bank, and you could be 16 years old and have your own offshore bank, essentially.
It's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah. So you have to move to the Bahamas.
Why?
You don't even have to move there.
Right.
You could be there digitally.
So let's talk about Ethereum. So Ethereum is being promoted by many in this space, at least from what I've read, experts, and I'm not one, that this is going to be the ultimate winner in cryptocurrency, that the technology that supports Ethereum is superior, I guess, from a utility perspective to Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Compare and contrast those two for us and the underlying blockchain technology.
So there's... This is unfortunately just kind of like a general cultural thing, or, you know, call it our Twitter culture, where I have to be 100% right and I have to prove that you're 100% wrong. So you do have these, you know, people that lock themselves into, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist or I'm an Ethereum maximalist and you're wrong. And you get this back and
competition,
forth.
Right. Yeah.
Well, but it's also this weird thing about I have to be right because my ego depends on it.
Right.
So to me, I'm a Bitcoin maximalist.
Okay.
You know? Okay. Because there are things about Ethereum which are really cool and interesting, but the challenge that Ethereum is going to have is that it is designed to be something that's super cool, but it's also designed to be something that means something to too many people at too many different times.
Elaborate. What does that mean?
Like Bitcoin does one thing very simply. And, you know, at the end of the day, and I think we may have talked about this in the past just in terms of the cool thing about Bitcoin is the decentralized governance of it. And once you start understanding why that's important, you'll realize that one of the challenges Ethereum has always had, it will continue to have, is the fact that they keep changing the rules of their system in order to be able to, quote unquote, evolve. But every time you evolve, you're leaving somebody behind. So you have to pick and choose losers in that system, where Bitcoin doesn't do that. Can't do that.
But I mean, what is the technology that has this broader application? You know, it's always talked about in vague generalities.
Yeah.
The blockchain technology, the technology is the real value. The blockchain footprint or design for Ethereum is better or worse than the blockchain design for Bitcoin. People don't understand what that means.
Well, so one thing is that what made Ethereum so exciting when it came out is that it was a lot easier to code on, meaning that the 20-somethings coming out of school gravitated to Ethereum because it was easier. You know, water seeks its lowest point. And I'm not taking away from that. But that's where a lot of the development talent went in 2015, 2016. The thing that's interesting about Ethereum is that it has what's essentially called Turing complete software that sits inside the code. So that allows you to be able to make agreements and contracts with people, and then they self-settle. So you don't have to worry about, you know, if you make a bet with somebody, like a sports bet, we don't have to worry about whether or not you think one team won or I thought another team won. It would just automatically settle. So the idea is that you could create this social ecosystem, and there's Ethereum, and then there's Cardano, and then Ethereum has about 25 different copycats that are trying to be like, we're the new Ethereum, we're the better Ethereum. I think at the end of the day, the first mover attribute of Bitcoin is going to make Bitcoin king because it does one thing, and it does one thing perfectly. And Ethereum's also going to survive and do very well going into the future because it has first mover status, and that's where the concentration of the software developers are spending their time developing Ethereum.
And so when people argue in terms of like Bitcoin and these other cryptos limited upside, that it, in order to maintain its attractiveness and its value, and to increase, it has to simultaneously be fringe and mainstream.
Yeah, and that's the balancing act that Ethereum is always caught in, is because, you know, if you talk to the original developers that launched the code, it was never meant to be currency. It was never meant to be a competitor of Bitcoin. It was meant to be something different, using cryptographic mathematics to do something more interesting or different. So the way that I kind of explain it to people is that Bitcoin's a lion and Ethereum's a shark, and they're both apex predators in their own environment. But they don't threaten each other because the shark swims and the lion doesn't. So that's, I think, a different way of thinking about it, where you don't have to say, like, I'm going to pick a winner. In fact, me personally, you know, I've got interest in both. Like, I want everybody to do well.
And you're not worried about big banks coming online with their own cryptocurrencies? You're not worried about the government moving in the direction of prohibition?
No, and that's kind of the interesting point of when you get into this space, is you realize how little control that people really have. You know, a U.S. dollar, you know, Janet Yellen coin would scare the living daylights out of me. You know, because, and this is why China's actually doing it. There's a digital yuan, pronounce it. But the scary thing about that is that you know what the Chinese do to people they don't like. You know, they can make you disappear.
Yeah.
And what if they could just make you financially disappear with the press, you know, with the stroke of a, you know, keyboard? And that's the scariest part about any government currency, is the fact that, like, now you have that governance thing, where in Bitcoin it's decentralized, nobody controls it. But in a government digital financial system, somebody controls it, or a group of people will control it. And you might be like, well, I trust these group of people today, but do you trust the group of people 20 years from now? Look what Argentina's doing with their currency. You look at these currency failures all the time, and people are just pressing buttons and robbing people of their wealth.
And how secure are these crypto accounts, or Coinbase, or anywhere else, in terms of protection against hacking, the protection against disappearance, like you were talking about the Chi-Coms could do?
Well, in the United States, we obviously have a lot better legal system that has a lot of financial protections. That doesn't mean it's going to last forever. I like Coinbase enough. I like Kraken. I like Gemini. I don't really have a one U.S. exchange. But as a U.S. citizen, the on-ramps and off-ramps between your U.S. bank account has to go through only a few exchanges. I cannot go to Binance as an exchange because I'm an American, but I can go to Binance US, which is a much smaller version of their large exchange. But then again, at the end of the day, that's where I try to encourage people to just, if you're going to get as far as getting into the space, then take the next one more step to learn how to actually take custody and control your own crypto. Because at that point, you're going to realize that you're going to be able to over-collateralize loans in the future. I mean, the financial opportunities that exist in this space are so cool, and they're not that far off.
He is Abe Froman Jr., Director of Operations at Digital Asset Redemption. Abe, thanks for joining us again with another tutorial, trying to keep up to speed with this as best we can. We appreciate it.
Let's hang out more often.
Very good.
All right.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the corruption of man and the corruption of language. Ralph Waldo Emerson made the connect when he wrote that the corruption of man is followed by the corruption of language. When simplicity of character and the sovereignty of ideas is broken up by the prevalence of secondary desires, the desire of riches, of pleasure, of power, of praise, and duplicity and falsehood take the place of simplicity and truth, the power over nature as an interpreter of the will is in a degree lost. New imagery ceases to be created, and old words are perverted to stand for things which are not. And isn't that a description of what has happened to our language and thus our culture in America? Well, somebody who is particularly persnickety about language, that is in part his business, is John McWhorter, who teaches linguistics, American studies, and music history at Columbia University. He's a contributing editor at The Atlantic and host of Slate's Lexicon Valley podcast. We've talked about his work a number of times on the show, and at the top of the or at the end of the last hour, you heard my recent commentary on him for townhall.com. His new book is showing the potty mouth side of John McWhorter. 9 Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever. Because of the George Carlin rule, most of these words we can't repeat, but it's an interesting read, as a McWhorter work always is. Regardless, John McWhorter, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What about that observation by Emerson, the corruption of man followed by the corruption of language? Is that a fair description of what has happened in this country not exclusively, but at the hands of identitarian politics?
Dan, I'm sorry, but no.
Okay.
That's not what 9 Nasty Words is about. I am delighting in these words, because the truth is that we're definitely a more informal culture. I mean, there was a time when you put language in its Sunday best in public and largely confined salty language to the private. That changed starting in the late 60s, and I don't know if we can ever go back. But as a linguist, for me, profanity is very subtle, it's very intricate, it's very complex. And so 9 Nasty Words is actually a book about not linguistic decline, but it's about delight in how complicated, say, the word that begins with F that, you know, we're all so familiar with, how complicated its usage is, such that to learn English for real is to master something that really is as complicated as how you might use a word like even. What did she even mean? Try telling a foreigner what even means in that sense. It's subtle. The F word is used in an equally subtle way. And so what I just discussed is what used to be considered profanity, which was blasphemy. And then there are the parts of the body, and that's what we're all familiar with, the body and sex and excretion. And nowadays, profanity is slurs against groups. It's all about what a society happens to be hung up on. But I wanted to write a fizzy book about the words that we consider transgressive, how they got that way, and where they're going.
Hey, but what about when words are used to describe things that aren't? And so I think, for example, of saying that a man is a woman, or that that's a good example. I mean, just saying that something that is biologically not is linguistically is. Is that a corruption of the language?
Well, in this case, I don't know if we're talking about language as much as we're talking about concepts and people wanting us to look at categories in a different way. That would be quite different from words that you use to transgress as gestures that are no longer words. And so in terms of using language to try to change people's minds and maybe even to be duplicitous, and frankly, I don't think of, you know, people talking about different gender categories as duplicitous, but that is just human. You know, part of why human language is so sophisticated is that we can actually try to get people to change their minds, or, you know, lie to people, or to say things that we know aren't true, which is something that comes along with language being so sophisticated. And then language is also sophisticated in that you can have something that's nominally a word but is actually a gesture that actually takes flight from anything we would consider grammar and becomes a kind of decoration.
Do you think people use profanity to look tough? I mean, especially a lot of women, you know, over the years, you've noticed that they start dropping the F-bomb more, but are they trying to be like men or trying to be taken seriously?
Well, yeah, it's at the point where profanity isn't as male as it used to be. Because in general, in any modern society, men tend to be more vulgar in their speech than women. You know, there are women who are, you know, like vulgarity in speech, there are men who don't. But the tendency is that slanginess is more associated with men. That's been changing over the past several decades so that it would be harder to draw that line. There's studies that show that, you know, especially younger women curse as much as men do. And that's because gender roles and gender conceptions are changing so quickly.
Do you think that contributes to coarseness in the culture, that the nature of dialogue? Obviously, you're suggesting not with some of these words, but even those, that sort of dialogue that now more that includes women more so than previously.
Well, definitely we are a more informal society than we used to be. And that would include what you might call coarseness. Many people would call it honesty. And so for many of us, there would be an aesthetic pleasure in watching, say, the people in old movies with their hats and, you know, with their controlled way of speaking, with the sense that there is a public way of using language and then a private way of using language that you can barely see in those movies, even among the comedians. So, yes, there is what you could call coarseness. I think many people would call it just real. And that's something that is happening with, you know, men and women. That's the nature of modernity. Some people like it, some people don't.
Well, so then is this a concept or a corruption of the language, critical race theory, and the suggestion that all whites are oppressors and all blacks are victims?
Yeah, that is a very narrow view of what education is supposed to be. That's a very narrow view of what society is. And we have this cadre of people who are under the impression that that is more important than anything else and that all people need to focus on that. The way, for example, all people used to be told that they were to focus on God. It really is a religion. And unfortunately, everybody is afraid of those people because if you go against them, they call you a racist on Twitter. That's basically what it comes down to. If you tell them that they're wrong, they call you a racist on Twitter. And most people don't want to be called a racist on Twitter. But it means that those people are acquiring a disproportionate power when really they're extremely anti-intellectual, they're prosecutorial, and they are replacing one kind of racism with another one and teaching us that it's progress. It's a very dangerous development.
Yeah, and from your work, as well as a recent interview you gave to Bill Maher, you really bristle at the condescension at the foundation of books like White Fragility in particular, probably How to Be an Anti-Racist as well. And you write in your review of White Fragility last year in The Atlantic, which was devastating, by the way, and devastatingly in a good way. You write, White Fragility is, in the end, a book about how to make certain educated white readers feel better about themselves. I don't know if there's a bigger indictment and would be feel like a bigger indictment if you said that to one of those people that you're talking about. I wonder why that isn't simply put to those people that are exercising outsized control over K through 12 education and all other aspects of our civil society.
Well, all they see is that they are trying to seek the highest good, which is to battle power differentials. They don't often think of it that way. But for them, getting white people out of power is the most important intellectual, artistic, or moral endeavor possible. And so they're beyond any kind of constructive exchange. You cannot change their mind. They think they found a new god. And so what you have to do is either work around them, or you have to let them know that they're not going to get what they want by calling you a racist on Twitter. And I think they have taken such power so quickly that a lot of us are still just stunned and staggering trying to figure out what we're going to do. But yeah, to them, any criticism of white fragility, it's blasphemy. It's something that they just brush off of their shoulder. They can't imagine that the critique would be valid in any way. I know that Robin DiAngelo actually has said about me that she's Neil deGrasse Tyson and I'm an astrologer. That's her response to my criticism. She thinks she knows more in a way that I don't. And, you know, so you can't reach that kind of person. But we have to get those people to sit back down at the table, because if we let them control the show, we're going back to the Middle Ages.
Well, right. And the key aspect of these of the approach that they take, and you're sort of getting to it, is they will not engage you. And they cover it, like I've seen Ibram Kendi cover it, by saying to engage someone like John McWhorter or anybody who's critical of How to Be an Anti-Racist is to legitimize their viewpoint, and their viewpoint is illegitimate, so it doesn't need to be addressed. It's a nice little artifice they use.
Yeah, for them. And I mean, you can put yourself in their minds. It's as if somebody is being asked to debate a pedophile. Like, is pedophilia okay? And we just figure, well, no, we have bigger fish to fry. To them, all of these things are that simple. I mean, to be honest, when you get down to Ibram Kendi, he's not the most reflective fellow in the world. he doesn't see these things in with any kind of nuance or any kind of detail. And so, you know, you have to work past him. We need to have a group of people who will conclusively, you know, unfortunately, it has to be shout down people like that and tell them that some of their contributions are welcome, but that they can't run the show. Because what they're equipped with is not, you know, sufficient to a modern society and how it can operate.
Right, but they don't want you running the show.
No, but it's at the point where if they learn that they can't get what they want by calling you a racist on Twitter, there'll be more room for the rest of us to start saying the things that we were saying before. All of us should be running the show, mm-hmm. but certainly not them alone.
What's your reaction to governors moving, and most recently Texas, to ban critical race theory indoctrination from school curriculum? My take, and we'll get yours, is I appreciate the sentiment, but I think it's the wrong tactic. I don't want to be in the business of banning anybody. I want How to Be an Anti-Racist and White Fragility to have to do battle with John McWhorter and Shelby Steele and Glenn Lowry and others in the classroom. So my petition is, go ask your school boards, your teachers, your professors, why can't we include John McWhorter's work? Why can't we include Glenn Lowry's work? Why can't we include Thomas Sowell's work in this discussion of race and culture? And if they won't include it, then they have to explain why. If the actual principals, Kendi and D'Angelo to take two, won't engage, then force the work into the classroom where you're going to be confronted by both sides.
Yeah, I mean, to ban critical race theory often ends up meaning, in practice, no discussing race issues at all. And that's not what I think is at all constructive. We do need to talk about those things. And there are some school districts where things like that need to be discussed more than they were. What needs to be banned is the idea that texts like Robin DiAngelo's work and Ibram Kendi's work are treated as basic and sacrosanct and often the only ones that are really engaged. That is a sinful, sinful transmogrification of what an education is supposed to be. But we're having problems with terms, because critical race theory should not be taken to mean that race is never brought up in class. Critical race theory should mean that white fragility is not taken as the Bible.
John McWhorter, he teaches linguistics, American studies, music history at Columbia University. He's a professor there, of course. He is a contributing editor at The Atlantic, host of Slate's Lexicon Valley podcast, and someone who enjoys nasty words more than even George Carlin, I might suggest. Nine Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever is John McWhorter's new book. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Building off of our conversation with Professor John McWhorter last hour about language, we're developing that a little bit with our next guest in terms of framing. One thing, what words mean and the idea of corrupting the language versus coming up with new concepts for things, as we were distinguishing with McWhorter a bit. But the issue of framing, how you frame a particular challenge or an issue, can be determinative in how it's resolved or if it's resolved. And that's the subject of a new book called Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil, which releases today. So you want to pick that up. One of the authors is Victor Mayer Schoenberger, professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford. He's also a faculty affiliate of the Belfer Center of Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. Professor Schoenberger. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Please do call me Victor.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you, Victor. Well, very, very informal. You like that? Don't get hung up on titles. All right. So just sort of as a baseline here, the importance of framing and problem solving and what led you into and you and your co-authors into this book.
Well, you know, we all face decisions every day, some inconsequential ones and some really hard and consequential ones. And most of us think that good decision making is about picking the right of the two options that we have or the three options that we have. And there is so much literature and there is so much research done on how good or bad humans are in picking one of those options. But as we looked into this topic of decision making, we realized it isn't about picking one of the two options. It's coming up with better options. It is coming up with better options than the conventional options that we always have on the table, because that will enable us to make better decisions. And that is something that we humans are really, really good at if we try.
So this deliberate framing you're talking about, give us an example. I read something where you reference how you got your mom's doctors to sort of reassess this medical condition she had because they weren't thinking about it right. And you got them to do some deliberate framing and it produced a better outcome for your mom. Give us that example.
Absolutely. My mom was in her late 80s, and she developed the condition, got to the hospital, and they discovered there that she also had a very high blood pressure. We had known that for a long time. So they gave her medication and pushed the blood pressure all the way down, and she became apathic, she lethargic, because of that low blood pressure. And I said to the doctors, look, you know, she's not leaving the bed. She's not going to get any better. Why don't we reduce that medication? Let her have that high blood pressure. I take the risk that she might die due to a stroke, but she will have life quality. She all her life had high blood pressure. That's how her body operates. Let's leave that body at that the temperature, so to speak, at that level. And they did. Fortunately, I was able to persuade them. And my mother got better very quickly. We got her out of hospital. She had 3 additional years of great life quality at home. She eventually died of a stroke at the age of 91, but she had a long life. And I thought that this was absolutely the right decision, reframing what was at hand an issue.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
This framing, though, it is not unmoored, or it shouldn't be unmoored. And you also, in the book you co-authored, talk about how you need to constrain your imagination to make frames effective. And you use the Israeli commando raid in Entebbe as an example of constraining imagination to make the framing effective.
Indeed, when the Israelis needed to free the hostages from Entebbe, they faced huge challenges. So they asked themselves, what if we do this? What if we do that? They construed in their minds alternative realities, how they are going to free the hostages. And then they said some of those ideas just don't work. And to find out what works and what doesn't, they actually build a replica of the Entebbe airport where the hostages were held in Israel, and then played the various scenarios out there at that replica in order to see what kind of option works best. Our mind is not particularly good when it goes all the way out in this sort of in the freewheeling kind of state. Our mind excels when it is constrained, when it is disciplined in its thinking. That's what the Israelis did, and that's what, quite frankly, Ronald Reagan did as well, 1987, when he said to Gorbachev, "Tear down that wall." He wasn't looking for Star Wars to intervene. He suggested a very actionable intervention that actually then happened. It is constraints that make our dreams actionable.
So, what about?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me an important point, and it's a way of framing it. You know, constraint and creativity are complements, not antonyms.
Indeed, and we are quite creative, but we are most creative when we have limits and when we are adhering to the limits. The great architect Frank Gehry said that he is constrained 85% of the time by the laws of gravity, but it's the 15%, the freedom that he has, that he is able to come up with great designs. And that's true in business, that's true in sports, and that's true in all of our individual lives as well.
What about the power of reframing COVID and the COVID response?
Absolutely. We see that in so many different ways. In New Zealand and Britain, two islands had two different approaches to COVID. One in New Zealand, they said that this is really like SARS, a dangerous pandemic, and they shut down the country very quickly, eliminated the virus, and within weeks were back online. And were COVID-free for many months. While in Britain, the government looked at it and said, well, maybe that's more like the flu, and so we need to mitigate it. And that didn't work very well in the first wave, although later on last year, thanks to a massive vaccination attempt and relatively clear government policies, the UK did much better than, for example, continental Europe. And so depending on how you frame the pandemic, whether it's the flu or whether it's a serious disease, you come up with different solutions in different contexts at different times.
Yeah, and then framing, though, can run up against the repetition, you know, repetition from those with the biggest blowtorch. And so, for example, you know, a catch-all explanations of COVID response policy, following the science and data, abundance of caution, when in point of fact, some of those responses, as we've seen most recently, even, for example, summer camp guidance from the CDC, are neither following the data and science nor reflect a reasonable abundance of caution. And so, you know, it seems to me that the propagandizing, and I'm using that as an example, you may agree or disagree, can really pollute framing of a particular issue.
You know, we make a very important point, I think, in the book, and I want to emphasize it very strongly. There is no bad frame. There is only bad framing. You know, when we look at it, and there's the frame of science, or the frame of epidemiology, and then there's the frame of liberty. And the argument we make in the book is that one isn't necessarily better than the other. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on the context. And it would be just terribly wrong to drown out and to scream out people who have another frame, who have another perspective looking at things, because we need the variety of these perspectives in order to come up with the best solutions. Otherwise, we end up with suboptimal solutions, and that can be pretty dangerous for society.
Amen to that. He is Professor Victor Mayer Schoenberger, Professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute at the University of Oxford, also the faculty affiliate of the Belfer Center of Science International Affairs at Harvard, The book, again, pick it up, Framers, Human Advantage in an Age of Technology and Turmoil, which is out today. Professor Schoenberger, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
All right. Time for animal story.
Well, this is a serious situation. Tracy Mintz has a miniature potbelly pig. She's had Cotton is its name for 6 years in Morton Grove. And Cotton is, you know, it's a domesticated animal. It's very refined for a pig.
She doesn't need a leash because she just loves, you know, she's not going to leave her food source or her family.
And better
something
than
they say about J.B. Pritzker.
Better than a dog. I mean, this thing, this cute creature, by the way, and I'll tweet out a picture of Cotton. He doesn't bark. Dogs are loud.
She's a good pet. She doesn't bark. She doesn't, you know, go on other people's property.
I think we're familiar with how a pig works.
Okay. You should see. They're walking Cotton down the street. It kind of looks like Bunky because he's the same spots, you know, same markings. But
although
now
that would be annoying at 6 in the morning.
No, but he doesn't. He's a very refined pig. But somebody, one neighbor complained. After 6 years, they've had this potbelly pig and everybody loves it. One neighbor complained because Morton Grove has an ordinance that you can't have farm animals in your house. And the family is devastated.
I could give her a life full of love. And I was receiving love from her as well. My pig
is
a pet.
That's too much detail.
Any animal can be a pet and its respective rights. But these village ordinances are out of date.
So here's the idea. Okay. The pig can identify as a dog and maybe stay. I mean, don't have animals have rights too? Or, I was really digging deep for this one, they could register Cotton as emotional support animal. Mm-hmm. And that could give them a leeway into keeping the pig in their house.
I love Cotton, and I've taken care of her since she was a baby.
It's like the end of Brian's song. I love Cotton. I hope you love him, too. Just as emotional as well.
Well, people, if you want to get
James
involved,
James Caan and Billy Dee Williams in a Cotton, the Cotton story, Cotton song.
There is a change.org petition. 3,000 people have signed it to keep Cotton in Morton Grove, or they could move, but they don't want to move. But they love it.
Why would you want to leave Morton Grove?
It's beautiful this time of year. Trenton, it's a suburb of Skokie and Lincolnwood.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, I know, because our parents grew up in Skokie. But still, Niles, Skokie. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. But seriously, I think they should consider the emotional support animal, because that's the best way to keep the animal in the house.
There's another solution.
What?
Have bacon for breakfast.
That's really weird.
It's
Wait, and you saw the picture of Cotton. Cotton's cute. Cotton's happy. Cotton's tail is wagging all over the place.
I love Cotton. With scrambled eggs.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I don't want to dwell too much on this, but I don't appreciate when St. Fauci tries to be too cute by half, as seemed to be the case in his exchange with Rand Paul on Tuesday, providing testimony on the Hill, talking about whether or not U.S. taxpayer dollars were used for gain-of-function research by the Chinese communists vis-a-vis the Wuhan Virology Lab. And Rand Paul took to Fox yesterday with Bill Hemmer to reiterate his claim and the basis for it, his claim against Fauci and the back and forth they had. You're lying. No, you're lying.
I would say we don't know for certain, but I would say what Dr. Fauci said yesterday was verifiably false. He said no NIH money went to the Wuhan Institute for gain of function. Well, the main doctor there, the one they call the bat scientist or the bat woman, is a woman named Dr. Shi Zengali. She wrote a paper that MIT scientists have looked at that they said was gain of function, meaning juicing up these viruses to make them very potent and infect humans. She wrote this paper, and in the paper acknowledged that her funding came from Dr. Fauci's group, the NIAID, which is part of NIH. So he's verifiably telling you something that is not true. Now, he may be quibbling and saying they weren't doing gain of function or they weren't supposed to, but we've looked at the grant application. In the grant application, we have a cellular biologist from Rutgers who says the grant application is for gain of function, juicing up these viruses. So Dr. Fauci came to Congress yesterday and lied. We can't prove the virus came from the lab. I'm not saying it did. I'm saying there is very much suspicious evidence that it might have.
And also this, there was a May 2017 event co-organized by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, Chinese Academy of Sciences, Wuhan Institute, and Hubei Society for Microbiology. According to the Wuhan lab, the event had five academic sessions, the first of which was, quote, gain of function research, gene editing, targeting and delivery, and other novel biotechnology, unquote. Among the Americans in attendance as special guests were professors that have received a combined 200 grants from the National Institute of Health, with 75 of those 200 coming from Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. So, you know, that's why I'm saying too cute by half. Whether it was intentional or unintentional, maybe it was just negligent. It wasn't purposeful. But his defiance belies the evidence, does Fauci's. And you heard Bill Hemmer asking the question there that got cut off. Well, what would Dr. Fauci have to gain by lying about this? Rand Paul's answer.
He's worried about culpability. So the person they put in charge of the investigation of whether or not the Wuhan Virology Institute had anything to do with COVID-19, the person they put in charge of the investigation was the guy who gave the money to Wuhan Institute. So they're circling the wagons, and they are deathly afraid that some evidence will come out that this virus escaped the lab. The doctor who runs the Wuhan lab said that she couldn't sleep at night afterwards because until she said, I figured out that it didn't come from our lab. She was worried to death it did come from her lab, but now do we take her word for it? She would probably be executed in China if she was responsible for this. She's probably, if it were there, destroyed the evidence. So we'll never know if it came from there. But my point is this. Should the U.S. government be funding these labs in China? China's a rich country. Why are we sending millions of our dollars to a secretive lab where we can't trust what they're doing?
Those are all good questions, and those are the kind of questions that should be asked. For more on all things COVID-related, please be joined again by Dr. Jonathan Ellen, who is a pediatrician, epidemiologist, public health academician, and the former CEO of Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. Dr. Ellen, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I don't want to envelop you in the political personality contest here, but what about that last point that Rand Paul made, the idea that, yes, I get collaboration among scientists in different countries, maybe more so with our allies than our enemies, but the idea that we should be collaborating with those individuals who may be good scientists but are nonetheless controlled by Chinese communists who don't have our best interests at heart. Does that make sense that in terms of taxpayer spend and collaboration?
It makes sense on several levels, actually. There's always been a real question about, you know, particularly Chinese, and I would probably throw Russia in there, in terms of grants that worked, federal grants to U.S. investigators to do work with and collaborate in those countries, because the ethics and the way they do the research and the transparency is different in those countries. And what kind of information and intelligence they can steal has always been a concern.
So I'm sorry. You're saying that the questions Rand Paul raised are legitimate questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's get to some of the hard science here in terms of what the pandemic responses has begotten. We were talking a bit about it earlier in the show. This piece in the Wall Street Journal, kids' weight gain in the pandemic is alarming doctors. There's a May study in the journal Pediatrics found the percentage of children aged 2 to 17 who are obese increased to more than 15% in June compared with 13.5% June to December of last year, I should say, compared to 13.5% the year prior, year over year. Biggest increase in obesity was children ages 5 to 9. Again, 2 percentage points, which is significant. Elizabeth Shepherd, who is the medical director of the pediatric weight clinic at Stanford's Children's Hospital, said she sees children with double-digit weight gains every day, both in primary care and the weight clinic. Sort of an underreported aspect of this while we're focusing on just giving kids the vaccinations at present. That's where the media is at.
Yeah, I think you and I have talked long about all these consequences of kids being kept at home, you know, including weight gain, which is what you're referring to. And then we've also talked about child abuse. We've talked about, you know, getting into adolescence and into substance abuse and addiction. So we've always talked about that there have been health consequences to the reaction and to the public health interventions around the pandemic.
Yeah, but what do we do now? I mean, it's hard to find somebody who hasn't gained weight, a child, because we shut down the playgrounds. We took away their sports. Our governor here took away travel sports.
Right. I mean, what you do now, is, you know, there's not a lot you can do now other than everything we've ever tried to help children bring down their weight and limit their obesity. So, hopefully we're opening up those spaces, and we should be opening up those spaces because they're outside and there should be no hesitation and resistance to that. That then comes down to,
There's legislation in Springfield, Illinois, so in the state of Illinois, that would propose a single free alcoholic drink as part of a promotion to get people vaccinated against COVID-19. Mm-hmm. So you get a beer in Illinois, you get a $100 savings bond in West Virginia. You could win $1 million or a full ride to a public college in Ohio. Should we do this vaccination cash and prizes, game show style?
Well, I think it's better than shaming and forcing people to do it, I guess. So, yeah.
And what about for 12 to 15-year-olds? There's other doctors, including a pulmonologist at the John Paul II Research Institute, who suggests that potential downside of the vaccine for somebody under 18 is worse than the potential downside for being infected by COVID. So why would they take it?
I would not argue. I don't think there's a lot of downside to the vaccine in general. I mean, that's generally where I am. So, but I do think that, you know, again, just like it's the parental choice and youth assent to getting the vaccine. And, I'm at the point where it's a personal choice issue.
Right, but do we need it? I mean, I did mine. My kids are younger. They're teens. I vaccinated both of them because for political reasons, because I want them to go back to school and to go back to a normal life as soon as possible. But I didn't do it for health reasons.
Yeah, and I think you're probably right, actually. I think the trade-off is limited for the individual. And I think you're right for more, you say political, but I sort of say public health reasons, where you can get the kids back in school. You know, if you want to go to a baseball game and they say you need to have a vaccine to go to the game, they can go. So I agree with you. I don't think there's a lot of benefit, but it seems to be the trend that we need to do right now.
There is, it's being marketed, getting vaccinated, as it not only protects you, but it prevents you from spreading COVID to others, even if you were to get reinfected. Is there evidence to support the claim that that the vaccine reduces or eliminates your ability to transmit?
We don't have direct evidence, but we do know that if it reduces the number of people who are forget about severity of infection, or it reduces the time that you are infectious, then the likelihood of spreading the infection goes down. The fact that it makes it an absolute no is not what I would ever say. But if you can reduce the time that someone's infectious, which would be consistent with the idea that the vaccine keeps people from expressing the infection, whether it's just a positive test or, in fact, a severe disease, would lead us to believe that the time that you're infectious drops. So I do think there's probably some benefit in to believe, strongly believe that it does help with that transmission. That's where the where I think the overstated issue and herd immunity comes from.
The overstated issue of herd immunity. What do you mean?
Well, that's what I wrote about in the last piece that I put in the City Journal, which was that we always talked about early on in the infection was everyone debating about how to get the herd immunity. Like when herd immunity was achieved, the light switch would go off and there'd be no infection and life would go back to normal. And so we've been sort of fed that for a long time. And for a long time, people believed, had debates about how to get the herd immunity, whether it was through natural infection and letting everyone get infected, except for the old people. And the other was vaccination. But in the end, we're never going to get to a point where there's not going to be endemic COVID. And part of what I've been arguing is by raising the whole idea of herd immunity, we've gotten people into this false belief that there's an end to this, and therefore we can push everyone hard to get to that end and take away sort of personal choice to get to that end. But that end is a very soft, squishy end. And so I think we're you know, as we start to hit the limits of how many people take the vaccine and how, you know, what the, you know, what level we hit, we're going to have some slowing in transmission, which is what you're going to get, but it's not going to be this on-off switch that they've sort of been telling people that it was going to be, particularly in the first 6 to 8 months of the infection.
Well, why can't we have that on-off switch? I mean, when can we go back to normal? Or is this the new normal? We're always going to have people in masks. Are we all, you know, not going to allow parents into sporting events?
No. No, actually, I'm sort of arguing the opposite. The new normal is to sort of recognize that those people who choose to get vaccinated are going to be protected for the most part. And the people who choose not to be are the people who choose. And if you're anxious, you can wear a mask. But at some point, we can't have continued mask wearing unless that's your personal choice. But the idea of providing guidance around it. So what I'm arguing is that there's a new normal. The new normal has to start to look like, to some degree, the old normal, with the recognition that some people are going to get infected in the background. There's not going to be zero cases, and some people are going to die. And if that scares you to death and you don't want to go out, that's your personal choice. But they need to open up venues. They need to open up businesses. They need to open up, because the risk the cost-benefit analysis, you know, this is something that Dan and I have been talking about. The cost-benefit analysis now favors a much more open society than we're talking about right now.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it's unfortunate that political leaders don't cut and paste what you just said. They're in the business of exaggerating, because the CDC is exaggerating and fear-mongering still. But you know, not to be critical of your profession, Dr. Allen, and feel free to be critical of radio talk show hosts too, right back at me.
Okay.
But I just found it remarkable, this survey that was published in the New York Times on what epidemiologists are doing now, what they will and won't do in terms of like how, what their risk tolerance is. The survey, share of epidemiologists saying they had done or would have done the following activities if necessary in the last 30 days. 6% would attend a sporting event, concert, or play. Only 15% exercised at a gym or fitness studio. Only 30% would eat indoors at a restaurant. That includes Tony Fauci on the 70% side. Only 32% would attend a small indoor dinner party. Only 39% hugged or shook hands when greeting a friend. I mean, these are the professionals that are providing cover for the politicians to engage in their fear-mongering.
Yeah, it did just come down on my group. But I think it's a very heterogeneous group, just like anything else. And I don't agree with a lot of them. And I think some of them, when you talk about what makes an epidemiologist, is somebody who's done, you know, sat there in a lab and crunched numbers, or someone who's been on the front line fighting infections and trying to control them. And I would, in most cases, I listen to people who've been on the front lines or who have tried to do classic public health at the front level and been an epidemiologist there. And I don't, you know, people are sitting just doing data analysis who haven't done frontline public health epidemiology are a completely different group of people.
That's well said. Good defense. Well done. Dr. Jonathan Allen, pediatrician, epidemiologist, public health academician, and the former CEO of Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. Check out his piece, After the Scourge, at City Journal, city-journal.org, which I'll tweet out. Dr. Allen, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.